So the topic today is the second foundation for mindfulness. Nakawe gave his great talk yesterday of the first foundation. And the second is, the subject is sometimes just called feeling, but to distinguish between the English idea of feelings being all are my emotions and everything, it's sometimes called feeling tones. Feeling tones. And what it means is that when it's explained, and it's explained very simply what these are, but it's so simple and so, I don't know, it sounds reductionistic, it sounds inconsequential, it sounds like, what's the big deal? And the feeling tones are the common, by the simplest way it said that all experiences have three tones. They're either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. So what's the, you know, okay, great, what? So what? But there's a big so what in the teachings of the Buddha. He put a tremendous emphasis on this particular foundation. And the kind of the reason for this is that the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, is the common denominator of all experiences. And if you know something about the common denominator, something that everything shares, then you become omniscient in a particular way. You know something about everything. And that gives you a toehold to freedom. That gives you a sense, a toehold to wisdom about how to be with all things. And it's another way of looking at it, everything goes through the funnel of feeling tones. Every direct experience you can have. If it's not a direct experience, then it's, who knows what it is. But I don't know, for the purposes of practice, it's not that important. For the purpose of practice, it's all about entering this world of direct experience. And the feeling tone is kind of like the little neck of an hourglass. Everything goes through there. So if you sit there at that narrow neck, you kind of watch everything pass through, everything occur, and it gives you a chance, an opportunity to develop a new relationship with everything and to understand something about how the feeling tone has a big impact on us. And you get a little bit more sense of its richness of this idea when you understand that the words being translated as pleasant and unpleasant are the Pali words sukha and dukkha. And certainly it's okay to translate as pleasant and unpleasant. It's probably appropriate, completely maybe the best English in this context. But the words also mean pleasure and pain, kind of extreme versions of pleasant and unpleasant. In some contexts, they mean happiness and suffering. The very thing that Buddhism is freeing us from is the suffering. So it has a very, now we're talking about something deeper and bigger and, you know, something richer and or multifaceted. And somewhere between pleasant, unpleasant, and happiness and suffering, sometimes you see these translated as ease and unease, which I like a lot. That kind of for me, it kind of covers it all. And I like ease a lot. I like things, you know. So you see now this, now it starts having maybe some little bit more fullness to it, this idea of feeling tone, where you have these different, it encompasses all these range of meanings, which means it encompasses a wide range of our own lived experience, our own lived life. And to be able to bring mindfulness to it is the task, to bring attention, to be aware of it. It follows the foundation on mindfulness of the body. That also gets emphasized a lot by the Buddha. It was a surprise to me to discover when I came to Buddhism how much being embodied and being present in your body, being aware through your body was emphasized in Buddhism and Zen. And where I practiced, it was very much an embodied practice then. But they didn't talk about that. The Dharma talks were often kind of heady or intellectual or enigmatic statements. But the practice of it was an embodied practice, very much being in your body. And when I went to Burma to practice this practice here, it was an embodied practice that was pretty much explicit that this, you know, the entry into deep vipassana was through the body, attention to the body. And we had these dramatic statements by the Buddha that there's no experience of enlightenment without mindfulness of the body. So as we become more sensitive to our body, more inhabiting our body, more embodied and aware through our body, then we have the opportunity to start experiencing things more personally, maybe more subjectively. And this idea of beginning to experience things more personally and subjectively is what begins happening in the second domain of mindfulness. Because it's not just simply the experience of the body, but now we're experiencing the impact, the effect that life has on us. And it goes deep inside that effect, and to our mind, to our hearts, to our inner life in some way. And so there's a kind of depth now we're looking into this. And this feeling, Tony, it's sometimes described as just kind of the pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant or unpleasant nature of experience. But as you, if you study this, how the Buddha teaches it, it's not quite such a, it sounds very neutral that way. Like it's just that, it's like a matter of fact. But it's now coming into our subjective world. And so there's a role in the experience of pleasant and unpleasant with liking and not liking, with having preferences, with having associations. And things can be, you know, there were things that I thought were awful tasting when I was a kid. And I remember the first time I had coffee, I thought it was like dishwashing water. But now I enjoy coffee. You know, it was kind of a little bit of acquired taste. There's things that I enjoy because of the associations that come with it or the meaning associated with it that maybe, you know. And so the whole world of pleasant and unpleasant begins to become richer. It's not just simple kind of plain pleasant and unpleasant. It has a richer kind of part in our life, and part of our inner responsivity to life also comes into play when we have these experiences of pleasant and unpleasant and neither. And then to make the whole experience even richer, in this teachings of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, teaching about feeling, the Buddha distinguishes between two kinds of feeling. Two general, I mean, at first there's three kinds, right? So let's try to be careful with the English language. So there's three kinds of feeling: pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant, unpleasant. Those three kinds can occur in two ways. There's a division or a distinction between two different modes by which we can experience these feelings. In both modes, it's pleasant, unpleasant, and neither. But it's two different kind of domains, kind of. And I don't know what you'll think about what the Pali term for these two domains is, of the flesh and not of the flesh. That's literally what it says. And some translators will say worldly and non-worldly. But, you know, that's pretty highfalutin language compared to of the flesh and not of the flesh. And so, but what does this mean? The best I've understood what it means is that of the flesh is experiences of feeling, these pleasant, unpleasant feelings, that occur when our senses, our nerves, are stimulated mostly by things outside of us. But ordinary sense experience. So if I kind of rub my hand across my knee here, it actually feels pleasant to me. And so my flesh is taking in that pleasure. The nerves that are there are taking in, and I feel the pleasure. If I have toast with cheese, let's say if I have toast with peanut butter, that's nice. I actually like it. I enjoy it. It's pleasant for me to eat. But if I have toast with butter and cheese, I like it. It's pleasant. However, it touches something much deeper inside of me, because one of the powerful transmissions of love I received in my life was from my grandmother. When I was a small boy, I'd stay in bed in her house, and I would be under these Norwegian comforters, and it was this beautiful light, this beautiful sunlight coming into this kind of mostly wooden back then. Everything was wood. And she would bring me on a tray, she would bring me toast with butter and cheese. And so when I have toast and cheese, it isn't just physical pleasure to eat it. It touches something deep inside, this love, something soft and warm and glowing. Gets kind of reminded. And it's kind of a rich kind of world. That's not of the flesh. That's some kind of deeper state of being that can arise. When I was 15, I lived in a boarding school, and I was walking. It was a beautiful place. So I was sent to boarding school up in the mountains. It happened to be a reform school, but it was a beautiful place. And one day I was walking in the mountain road with a classmate, 17-year-old, and I looked up at the mountains in the sky, and I said something like, just in awe, I said, why are we here in this cosmos? And he looked at me in kind of disdain and said, don't be silly. And when he said that, something inside, deep inside, closed. It was unpleasant to hear that. But something closed inside, and it's okay, I'm not going to show that to anyone ever again. And that was closed, and that sense of tightness and constriction in there, that was not of the flesh. The unpleasantness of his words was of the flesh, but the way impact it had on me was not of the flesh. That was kind of like the deeper quality of my heart, my heart state, my mind state, my state of being that was inside. So the Buddha made a distinction between these two different domains. And so we start becoming aware in the foundation of mindfulness, not only about whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral in and of themselves, but we also, with time, are able to make a distinction between those things that are of the flesh, kind of like that it mostly basically involve external objects. Oddly enough, your thoughts and ideas and concepts and stories are considered to be of the flesh as well. So that doesn't get you off the hook, you know, that's of the flesh. That can just be, you know, and I've known people who've just used mental ideas and thoughts and all kinds of things to just to stimulate pleasure and joy and delight in a way, because just to have pleasure and of some kind. And it's kind of the flesh then. Of the not of the flesh is something deep. It really has a depth inside of us, and is often more enduring. Of the flesh is like a nerve stimulated. Something has to be stimulated. Not of the flesh is something that can last, and this not of the flesh is also what where our conditioning affects us the most. So, like my friend who said, "Don't be silly," and something closed. That condition affected something deep inside. My grandmother affected something deep inside. And that was enduring. And both of them endured for a long time. And luckily, my grandmother's lasted longer. And the So Nakawe referred to Thich Nhat Hanh's book this morning, and it has a wonderful title, Transformation and Healing. How does healing occur? The reference point I have for healing is a cut. You're in the kitchen, you cut yourself a little bit with a knife. Not too deep, just enough for the example I'm giving. You don't do the healing. What you do is create the conditions for the healing to happen. You might clean the wound. You might cover it with a Band-Aid. You don't go, work in the compost pile or the septic tank because it needs to be fixed with your cut hand. You kind of protect it and create the optimal conditions for it to heal. And then the body marshals together its capacities for healing, which is involved probably lots and lots of complicated physiological phenomena. And over time, the body heals. We create the conditions. The Buddha mostly taught his orientation, his way of thinking, was not cause and effect, but was about conditions. And practice has a lot to do with putting in place conditions that allow something to grow and develop. The word for practice in Buddhism is not like the English word practice. It's often translated that way. It's bhavana, which sometimes is translated as to develop or to cultivate. And to cultivate, it literally means something like the process of becoming. And just like a child grows taller, if everything's right for the child, and the food and love and all these things, they grow and develop. A gardener, cultivates a plant. The gardener doesn't cause the plant to grow. The gardener creates the condition. Parents don't cause the kids to grow well. They just create the conditions. Hopefully just good enough conditions that the kids can manage with the mistakes the parents make. That's the best we can hope for sometimes. But create the conditions that support them. So practice is also about bringing together conditions that allows for a healing or a transformation, a maturation, a growth within us. And this is very important because not a few people get the idea that they have to do it. They're responsible for making something happen. And they have to huff and puff. And maybe they've been a good doer in their past, and they're used to putting their mind to something and doing it, and then, boom, they do it. And it's like the story that of this, I apologize for the specificity of the person, the kind of person I'm talking about, if it's offensive to anyone. But this is the way these stories are told traditionally, usually. There was a young, capable, wealthy, smart man, young man who was capable and was able to do all kinds of things in his life, and whatever he put his mind to, he could do, and he was quite accomplished, but it wasn't quite good enough for him. But he felt this longing for awakening, for enlightenment. So he went to the monastery, and he wanted to interview and talk about coming there, and he asked the abbess, how long will it take me to get enlightened if I come here? And she said, well, about 10 years. And he said, oh, but I'm so capable. I can just put my mind to it. And, if I really give myself over to it and put my mind to it, how long will it take then? Oh, she said, well, then it's probably about 20 years. There's something about, trying to be the agent for spiritual change that actually interferes with something. And so there's something, we have to offer something ourselves. You can't be passive, exactly. But you can't also try to be the doer. You're the gardener. You're creating the conditions and nurturing the conditions so something can grow. And this relates to this feeling tone, that what are the conditions that you're putting in place that supports this inner, not of the flesh, the spiritual, this inner well-being? What conditions go into there? Do you contribute to ones that let something flourish, some sense of abundance, or do you contribute something which is draining and leaves you empty in some way? The Buddha talked about the importance of filling that inner, not of the flesh place. And that part of the function of practice is to begin to fill it so it's full. There's a filling of awareness, filling of with attention, filling with a sense of aliveness and embodiment, a filling with a sense of goodness, a wholesomeness, a sense of well-being from the inside that wells up and grows. And if you're full that way, not that you're full of yourself, but if you're full of the Dharma, then the Buddha said, Mara cannot get a toehold in you. Mara can't get you. But if you're empty, then Mara can fill you with all of Mara's gunk. So Mara is kind of like the force of temptation, the force of... some scholars say the word Mara comes from the word death in Pali, Marana, and related. And so it's that which is deadening. So all the things that are deadening, if you're empty, then Mara comes with all the deadening forces and pours them in instead. But if you're full, then, you know, it doesn't have, you know, there's no space for Mara to do anything, and you're protected in a certain way. So to give maybe a silly example is, if someone told me that Dharma teachers who wear gray sweaters are lousy, if I was having a hard day and feeling kind of empty and drained and fatigued and hungry and just felt, you know, somehow discouraged with things, who knows what, you know, just kind of emptied, and someone said that, oh, it must be true. Oh, you know, and so that pours into that empty space. But if I sat here with you meditating like I just did and felt kind of settled and calm and peaceful and felt kind of had a nice feeling of being present, then if someone said that to me, it's like there's no room for that to land. It's like, you know, there's not, I'm already full. And so there's no room for that to happen. So to begin to appreciate that that the practice is also about, first, it's recognizing the pleasant and unpleasantness of experience, and then beginning to recognize the difference between sensual pleasure and what maybe some people would call dharmic pleasure, dharmic well-being. And then learn how to create the conditions for the dharmic well-being to begin to grow and develop, however slow it might be, to give space for that and support for that. So the feeling tone, so another reason, one reason why this is very important is that many human beings think they're sophisticated, and their sophisticated responses to the world is because of their great philosophy and everything, whatever. But it turns out that an amazing, a high degree of our ways in which we respond to reality is amoeba-like. Is that if it's pleasant, we want more, and if it's unpleasant, we want to push it away or get away from it. And that's often masked because we do have philosophies, we do have all kinds of reasoning and ideas and justifications that we put on top of it. But if we sit and get really quiet and quiet the mind enough not to have the justifications kind of, you know, covering what's happening, you can actually feel the simplicity of you feel something pleasant and we go towards it. We want more. Feel something unpleasant, we have aversion to it. It's not wrong that we do that. We're like evolutionarily built to do this kind of stuff, so you don't have to feel bad about yourself for that. But it's invaluable to start seeing how the game is played, to have the ability to be mindful enough to see that there's pleasure, something's pleasant, and there arises a thought of, I want that. The first time I saw this and with great clarity was when I was in practicing this, doing this practice in Burma. And I went almost every day I went into my teacher's little cabin to do a practice discussion. And as you walked in through the door on the right, there was an altar, and there was all these Buddhas there. I don't know what they were. I have no idea what they were doing there, but nothing ever changed. And then one day I walked in, and there was a new Buddha on it. And I watched my mind step by step go like this. It was very fast, but I could watch the steps. Buddha, new Buddha, pleasant, I want it. And I just kind of like, wow. And I want it didn't go anywhere. I was like, I was so full with attention and awareness. And so I just saw that, and it just like, there's no movement to grab onto the I want, or to feel bad that I feel like, oh, I'm a bad Buddhist because I want. It was just, it was like, look, there's a cloud in the sky. There's an I want in Gil's mind. But to see it so clearly, boom, 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 and the connection between, and that was the kind of beginning, and then of seeing it in many situations, and pleasure, unpleasantness, and seeing the reactivity of the mind, the movement for or against, just a simple movement for or against. To be able to see that with clarity puts us in the present moment, and it saves us a lot of headache of trying to analyze and figure out why is it there, where did it come from, and what do I have to fix in my life so it doesn't happen. If you're able to sit this very simple place where you can kind of watch the going for and against, and if you're clear enough, you just see the movement, the impulse, but you don't do it, for it. Or if you get really quiet, sometimes just the pleasant arises, and it's just pleasant. It's just pleasant. It's unpleasant. It's just unpleasant. I believe that, I believe political philosophies, political positions that people have, a lot of time have their genesis in someone simply being, something was unpleasant. And something in the world which they felt is really unpleasant, so they were going to get rid of it, and they built this justification to get rid of what they thought was unpleasant, or to get what they want as pleasant. So it's a really deep operating thing. And so it gives a lot of power to the people who have the ability to be quiet enough, still enough, personal power, to watch at that place. So it's just pleasant. It's just unpleasant. I don't have to do anything about it. It's power in the sense that we have more than ability not to give in to or succumb to the reactions of wanting and not wanting, pushing away or holding on or something. And so that's part of the power of this sitting and being mindful of Vandana. But the deeper value of it is that as we get familiar with this, the things are pleasant, unpleasant, and in all the variations, and all the way up to, happiness and suffering, ease and unease, that we start being able to distinguish between that which is of the flesh and how, if we pursue those, that it they don't fill us with something important. In fact, sometimes pursuing sensory pleasure, there's nothing inherently wrong with having sensual pleasure. But we know a lot of people who pursue it in such a way because they're trying to have sensual pleasure to fill how they're empty, or to cover over a scar that they carry so that people don't have to feel it. So they do alcohol, they do drugs, they do sex, they do Sudoku, they do cat videos, and it's pleasant, but it's most of those, I'm not going to say all of them, I don't want to cross some lines here, But many of them are the pleasure's only there when it's we have the stimulation. And many people then, when the stimulation goes, we're left with the emptiness, we're left with the void, we're left with the scar, we're left with the feeling closed and how uncomfortable that is. And so the solution is to want more and want more. I had this experience of this when I was, don't know, a long time ago. I worked at a bakery in my 20s. And so mostly what I ate for breakfast, lunch, and dinner was wheat. And so I developed a wheat allergy. But I'd never heard of wheat allergies before. I had no idea such things existed. And so I had no idea what was going on with me. But what would happen, and I would start feeling kind of off. I'd start feeling kind of miserable or something, or a little bit depressed. And so I would go for my comfort food. And my comfort food was baguettes. And I was working at the bakery. They made baguettes. So I would eat. That would make me feel worse. So what's the solution? More baguettes. Because I didn't make the connection. And there were times, I remember going through San Francisco, walking down Market Street in San Francisco, and I felt like my mind had stopped working, was numb. And I felt like, I need to be institutionalized because, I was searching for comfort in the very thing that was causing me discomfort. So this was unpleasant. The search for pleasure to get away from what was unpleasant in a way that just didn't fill me, and that emptied me more and more, was deadening for me. So the wrong pursuit of pleasure is a huge thing in our society, and a huge misunderstanding. And I think it's a misunderstanding that should be respected deeply. We shouldn't be kind of dismissive of it or critical of it, because it's not so easy sometimes to distinguish between pleasure of the senses and some deeper sense of well-being. And the search for some deeper sense of well-being sometimes is misdirected, but sometimes that's the only thing that they've ever known that would provide them with something, happiness or well-being. And so the more sensory pleasure, the more we know we're successful, we're doing well, we're good people, and we're somehow. But when we come to the Dharma, to start kind of being mindful of this world of feeling tone gives us a chance to begin to tease apart where some enduring and more deeper form of happiness and well-being resides. The pleasure that's not of the flesh, the spiritual, the dharmic pleasure. But it's also, this not of the flesh is also a place where we do feel deep suffering. It's the place where our conditioning has the most effect. So if, and how we live our life has an impact on this conditioning of this not of the flesh place, the spiritual or dharmic place that's inside. And one of the ways that we kind of cause a certain kind of, we undermine ourselves in this kind of deep inner place is self-talk. If we have talk, we constantly critical of ourselves, mean to ourselves, then it actually has a kind of a sting in that place inside, and creates conditions. It doesn't happen. It's not free. You do. It's not like impact free. It's a conditioning, and if we do it over and over and over again, it begins to create kind of a feeling of soreness, of ache, of pain, of emptiness, of lack, deep inside. And then that, for some people, then becomes proof that there's something wrong with them, and so therefore they have more reason to be critical of themselves. And it becomes the cycles, as it was with me with baguettes. It kind of self-reinforcing until we kind of spiral down. So the idea of seeing, beginning to see that certain thoughts we have are unpleasant, maybe that initially they're unpleasant of the flesh, but the repeated impact of them can have a very deleterious effect over and over again. And then it's very hard to understand how that happened, because each little thought just seemed like a little thought, and it seemed like true. And how do we find our way out of that? And then we try to figure out how, you know, what's the solution? What do I do? What do I have to practice? Do I do? And maybe there's no practice to be done except a practice that begins reconditioning you, that begins bringing another influence on ourselves. And so, and not pleasure, not physical pleasure, but some deeper sense of well-being, something that nourishes that wholesomeness, nourishes something good inside, that awakens the good inside us. And so the wholesome, so what can you do to support the wholesome, the pleasant of, not of the flesh? And some of that has to do with understanding how this works, so that we can avail ourselves, be willing to take in the goodness that's here already. I'm confident each of you have a lot of goodness in you, a lot of wholesomeness. I don't think anybody could come to do this kind of practice here and not have a fair amount of it. You might not believe it, but I believe it. And you're in a field here of IRC, which is a field of goodness. Avail yourself of it. Allow yourself to appreciate it. Take it in. When the cooks bow to you in the before the meal, be sure to be there to bow back. Because, I mean, they're there. That's just their overflowing with generosity and love that they're doing this. I mean, where can you go that, you know, they're like my grandmother. Go there and receive, you know, take it in and appreciate. Oh, these people are volunteering their time to make food for us. You know, there's, you know, the gardens here are kind of nice, beautiful. Here people are taking care of them, and there's goodness here. And so, and then you're doing your yogi job. Maybe that's a good thing you're doing in the world. You're contributing something. Could you just appreciate, take in, even if you sometimes you feel groggy or not quite ready to do it, but you're still doing it. Avail yourself of the joy, the well-being. Avail yourself of the goodness that is here. Don't shortchange yourself of your own goodness. And this idea of availing yourself means to open and allow something to come in. And that's one of the reasons why this mindfulness of the body is so important. Because as we learn to wake up the body, be present for our body, the body becomes the receptacle. It has more and more room for this not of the flesh well-being to fill it. The image the Buddha gives of this being filled is one. There's all these wonderful images that have to do with the jhana practices, some of them, but some are not with those at all. But it usually has to do with water that's flowing and filling. And so like with the concentration practice, it's first the sprinkling of drops of water in a flour to make a dough and saturating the dough. And then as it gets stronger, it's this lake with an underwater spring from the bottom of the lake that's fresh water is coming into the lake and flowing through the lake. And this represents very clearly this idea of something inside us. It has room to grow and to flow and to glow inside of us. And so we're kind of like making room. It begins, that comes alive when we're well connected to our body. So I'm going to have to drink if I'm going to continue. So part of the function of mindfulness of the body is to create breathing room, to create space, by being more and more connected and grounded, and so that something can be in flow and fill your body, and so something can become reconditioned. If we're only in our heads thinking and taking in ideas and even inspiring ideas, it might just be something that's keeping the world of the flesh going and feeling pleasant and engaged and inspiring. How do you get out of that flesh thing and into something deeper, the dharmic place inside, and let that be conditioned and supported? And one of the ways is to have a body that's woken up, body that's become more sensitive and can take in, feel more deeply. As the body feels more deeply, it both fills up with wholesomeness, and it also, the doors open, the windows open. So some things not only won't stick, won't fill, but they just go right through the doors, out the back door. All kinds of things can happen in the world which are unpleasant. People can say mean things. And the more we're kind of at peace with ourselves, settle in ourselves, fill with ourselves in a good way, the less it matters what people think about us. We're not looking for approval. We don't need to apologize for our existence. We don't have to believe that somehow we're inadequate. So this idea of becoming full from the inside out, not from the outside in, and to sit, to walk, to be on retreat, and take the time it takes, have the dedication it takes to lovingly, gently keep connecting to your direct experience here, to now, to here, to this. Thich Nhat Hanh talked about home. This, maybe if that metaphor works, you keep coming back to the home of your body, from which you can be sensitive and connected. Maybe as things come along, you become your own loving grandmother. And it's not that you're receiving, but it's flowing out of you, and you're giving, you're providing it to others and to the world. So I've talked today about this Vedana, which can be presented very simply, but suggesting that it's actually connected to a very deep and rich part of our inner life and our world on many different layers, and much more we could say about it. But I don't want to leave you that it's so complicated or so much. I want to leave you that it's actually quite simple. And the simplicity, it opens up and opens up as you stay simple with it, just to feel and be present for what actually is in a direct experience. And you might see what it's like to recognize, without the ambition, without making it a big project, but to begin recognizing the pleasant and unpleasantness of experience. The neither pleasant nor unpleasant is not so common, but it's there sometimes. And in this exploration of what's pleasant and unpleasant, in the Dharma, you are allowed to experience the pleasant. You're allowed to experience the unpleasant for sure. But I think most people need to be told you have permission to feel the pleasant. You have permission to feel joy. You have permission to be happy. And so to begin allowing that, make room for it. Be able to recognize this little hints. Where are the little clues inside, that you might have some sense of delight or well-being or joy or happiness? You're allowed to feel that. More than you're allowed to feel it, it's part of the transformation. It's part of the healing. It's part of the growth and cultivation that needs to happen if we're going to fill ourselves in this, with all this wholesomeness, so Mara can't get us. And this is one of the things that Thich Nhat Hanh understood so well. And he was always talking about smiling. And he suffered a lot. He knew about the suffering of the world. He wasn't Pollyannish about it. And he talked about, you know, walking and every step feeling joy, breathing, being calm, breathing, feeling joy, breathing, being home. And really kind of emphasized it. It was a kind of mind-blowing when we met it, when Thich Nhat Hanh came to San Francisco Zen Center, to have someone say that, because back then at Zen Center, it was just kind of stoic, kind of strict, kind of just show up and be present and sit through everything, kind of macho Zen, and get out of the way. We're serious here. And then Thich Nhat Hanh came, and he was really serious. But his seriousness included joy and happiness and peace and calm. And he was so serious about it that he lived it. Imagine that. You can't be too serious if you're serious about joy. So I hope that this gives you something to practice with. More than that, I hope that it inspires you to take your time to just be with your direct experience more. And you know, it's so easy to lose touch with it. It's so easy to go into your thoughts, ideas, stories, and then you're not in your direct experience. See if you can lovingly return and be here in the direct experience, so that you begin discovering the value and the freedom and the wholesomeness that comes from being mindful and being present for your experience. It's a wonderful path you're on, and thank you for being here and sharing your path with us.